The future of rural health care is tied to technology and innovation. From SDPB, today is Thursday, October 17th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Sanford Health hosts their third annual summit on the future of rural health care. Their Chief Medical Officer of Virtual Care joins us with a preview and a look at digital equity in the healthcare field. Musician Scott Simpson has new music to share. He takes us into his collaboration with AI and with an earlier version of his artistic self. Plus, a Sioux Falls fry bread restaurant has released a companion children's book. Owner and first-time author Lawrence West is with us. We'll explore the Lakota food traditions of first we harvest, then we cook. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The future of rural healthcare and the future of virtual healthcare may go hand in hand. Dr. David Newman is Chief Medical Officer for Virtual Care at Sanford Health. He's a speaker and moderator at Sanford's third annual Summit on the Future of Rural Healthcare. The theme this year is Pioneering Innovation in a Shifting Landscape. Dr. Newman joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio to preview the summit and discuss innovation in healthcare. Dr. Newman, welcome. Thanks for stopping by the Sioux Falls studios here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And normally your work with the Sanford organization encompasses what exactly? Let's start with what you do, and then we'll get into why you're here in town now.
Sure. So I am the chief medical officer for our virtual care initiative. In my doctor role, I'm an endocrinologist and informaticist, but I've taken on more of an enterprise role trying to deliver high-quality, high-value care to the entire footprint virtually.
All right. And that means a whole lot of rural spaces.
A lot of rural spaces, yes.
A lot of us live far away from healthcare providers.
Exactly.
And to get there, we have to go through snow.
But you don't have to go through snow now. That yeah. If you want to see your providers virtually, that should be an option.
Let's talk about that, how that is changing and growing, the ways to see your provider virtually.
Yeah, so you can see your primary care provider virtually most of the time. You can see your subspecialist virtually. If you're uncomfortable with technology, you can go into a satellite clinic. You can go to a remote clinic, and they can set up a virtual appointment for you. So instead of our patients in our rural footprint that are driving 5 to 6 hours to see a subspecialist, they can go to their local clinic in Dickinson, North Dakota, or in some smaller cities in South Dakota and see their subspecialist remotely from a different clinic.
What do you mean that you can go to a virtual clinic and they'll set up your appointment for you? I don't understand what that
so
looks like.
So there are clinics that are typically staffed by primary care providers, but they can have the subspecialist at their home clinic virtually see the patient at the outside clinic.
Okay. How much has this advanced in the last 4 years, which would put us back to the pandemic, really?
Right. So during the pandemic, this was utilized a lot more often. We've gotten a lot better at it over the last several years. So we've gotten the technology down to so you can use your phone or your computer at home, and it's only a couple clicks to get there. I typically tell my patients it's easier than getting on Facebook, or it's easier than ordering a pizza online.
Obviously, if the choice is not being able to get there and seeing a provider virtually, then you would say, well, the wait, you know, is on definitely using the virtual appointment. But if you had some options, has the quality of virtual care on par with being there in person?
That's a phenomenal question. And what I typically say is it's the right care for the right patient at the right time and place. So not everything is suitable for virtual care. But for a lot of visits where you're following up on labs or you're following up on your imaging, some 5-minute follow-up appointments are much better done digitally than in person. There's not a lot of reason for patients to drive, you know, 3 or 4 hours, spend a night in a hotel for an appointment that can be done from the comfort of your own living room.
Yeah, taking that time off work,
right.
Leaving behind the farm or operation, figuring out what to do with your kids. There's a lot of obstacles there. Talk a little bit about learning how to be a good provider online, because that has to be a different thing for maybe not for younger providers. Maybe they're learning this in med school.
This is a phenomenal question. So when I went through medical school in the early 2000s and I was taught bedside manner, I was never taught website manner. So now as we go through, I'm learning digital strategies to effectively deliver virtual care. part of our new virtual care center, which is opening next month, is going to be an education institute where we teach nurses, where we teach healthcare providers the art of digital medicine.
Mm. All right. Well, let's get started on what some of those challenges are for the provider then to have website care.
Yes. So we're used to having a patient roomed in an office, having vital signs in front of us, and knowing what the routines are there. We're not used to having the patient where they feel comfortable to see where they're getting the healthcare delivered. We're setting up in our new virtual care center a patient experience lab where it looks like a patient's living room, and it can flex to a hospital bed to see how we can effectively deliver care to the patient at home.
So nurse, they're in a nursing home. They're in a in their personal home. There might be a dog or a cat running by.
Exactly. But those are the things that make it special. So
yeah.
A couple years ago, I was delivering what I call a virtual house call. So these are appointments where the patient's in, where they feel the most comfortable. And I looked in the background, and I saw the patient had a Red Hot Chili Peppers poster up.
Nice.
And now that's what we talk about on their visits. So it's a glimpse into their own home life where they're very comfortable, and it can actually be more meaningful than an appointment in person.
Yeah. What do you have to make sure that you don't, quote unquote, miss in the appointment that maybe you would see if somebody was sitting in front of you?
So there's a lot of things that you wouldn't think of. So you've got to talk about which pharmacy they want to be at. You've got to talk about what to do if they need an emergency cares. You've got to talk about where they need to get labs or imaging done if they're not familiar with that. So there is a lot of ancillary work that needs to be supported with that.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the future of Rural Healthcare Summit that is coming up. You're here for town. What do you imagine getting people in the room and some of the conversations, some of the synergy or networking that might happen? Give us a big picture of what that might be like.
So we're excited for this. This is the third annual summit that we've had. We're bringing together some of the most dynamic and influential voices in healthcare, technology, and business. This year's summit is focusing on pioneering innovation in a shifting landscape. One of the things that really makes our summit different and unique is that we bring together diverse voices to have solutions-focused conversations in some of the most pressing challenges facing healthcare today. We don't just talk about what the problems are, but we want to focus on solutions.
Mm-hmm. Some of those responses or solutions, what are some of the challenges that you're still hearing? I mean, the things that come to my mind are just access to broadband, you know, having a good connection, knowing how to use it. The training we've talked about. What are the other challenges that you're trying to meet the moment of?
Yeah, so access is definitely one of them. So not just access to broadband, but access to high-value, high-quality primary care and specialty care. Mm-hmm. We also talk about quality. So we don't want the quality of care to be defined by your zip code. That everyone should have access to high-quality primary and subspecialty care. Sustainability is another big problem that we have. We've got workforce problems and expensive solutions. And we need to discover new ways to make healthcare relevant for the next 20, 25 years.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is interesting is when you go to some of the facilities, I don't think this is going out on too far of a limb, but if you live in South Dakota, especially if you live in Sioux Falls, and you go get care at a Sioux Falls facility, it's going to be a nice facility. A lot of thought has been put into parking and artwork and, you know, what the offices look like. You feel like you're in a pretty good place and you meet some pretty high-level doctors. A lot of money has gone into then creating and building these physical structures. Now this money is going also into building digital infrastructure and training for this. This sounds expensive in some ways to pivot to a new future, and people still expect to be able to go to a doctor's office in their hometown of Sioux Falls and see a nice facility. So the challenges of cost and developing what's next in healthcare has to be a challenge too.
You're absolutely right, is that we are trying to be solution orientated and decreasing the total cost of care. And when I say the total cost of care, we talk about miles saved. We talk about carbon footprint. We talk about all of these things, cost of medications. We want digital care, and we want a lot of the solutions that we're going to be talking about at the summit to complement all those things.
What are you excited about?
I am so excited about the summit. So we've got an all-star cast of people coming. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the 23rd commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, is joining us. He's going to be talking about innovation and artificial intelligence. Dr. Bruce Scott, who's the president of the American Medical Association, will be on a panel on policy and politics and advocacy. Dr. Alex Oshmiansky, who's the founder and CEO of the Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drug Company, We'll be talking about healthcare disruption and prioritizing affordability. We also have our own CEO, Bill Gasson, who will be joining a panel along with lots of other people.
What are you excited about the future of AI? How is it impacting your work as a doctor?
So AI has already impacted lots of doctors' work, but we see it as a tool. At Sanford, we're committed to working with AI to make sure it's safe and effective for patients before we roll it out.
As an endocrinologist, and when we talk about technology moving forward, I think of diabetes care, and that might be a great example. So help us understand how some of that technology has advanced so rapidly and how virtual care models might apply.
Great question. So I've been doing this for about 20 years. When I first came out of residency and fellowship, people had to poke their finger with a sharp piece of metal to get what their blood sugar or their blood glucose was. Over time, we've advanced to now you can wear kind of a sticker on your arm to check your blood glucose. So you get multiple values a minute to tell you where if you're dropping high or dropping low. Even more sophistication has come out over the past 4 or 5 years where patients with type 1 diabetes and some with type 2 wear a pump, which is like a pager or like a cell phone that you wear that contains insulin and delivers it based upon what your blood glucose levels are. So there's an artificial intelligence algorithm that looks at whether your blood sugar is going high or low, and it learns your algorithms and is like an artificial pancreas. And it is actually more effective than a provider is at controlling your blood glucose levels.
That's Dr. David Newman, Chief Medical Officer for Virtual Care at Sanford Health. The Summit on the Future of Rural Healthcare is Tuesday, October 29th. Learn more about the event and where to live stream it at sanfordruralhealthsummit.org.
I'm burying my head deep into a distant May, a stretch from this late January. Where an unseasonable warmth has reawakened these lilacs beneath my skin.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A little bit there from the new song Artifacts from Black Hills musician Scott Simpson. The song is available now on the new album called Where the Growth Begins. Now, every song on the album began as a poem before growing into something new, and that growth is the theme of the album. Simpson says he collaborated with both AI and with his younger self to create a new chapter in the present. He joined us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
Was my dream. I dreamed to be a poet, and you know the only way you can actually make money doing that is by teaching. You're not going to rake in the bucks publishing poems, but I managed to get there. I was a college professor for a while, and I was among other things teaching the writing of poetry. And part of what is told in this piece, and part of the reason why it's so important now at this point, and I don't want to throw any institution under the bus or anything, but academia is not always friendly to poetry, mm-hmm. and not always friendly to art in general. Mm-hmm. And I was on that tenure track. Game of publishing or perishing, and
yeah.
I was publishing quite a bit. But I was told at one point, though they hired me with a PhD in poetry writing, I was told it would take a stack of published poems to the ceiling to be the equivalent of one peer-reviewed research publication. And this was that's not the attitude across the board, but that was the particular attitude of that particular dean. So I, it was a kick in the gut.
Yeah.
And what happened to me around that time is I shifted to something that I felt was still an outlet for me, that I could just do without needing any of that, which was, music.
Yeah.
Which I had already been involved with, but I saw the two things as a little bit separate. In a nutshell, at that time, I think I felt like taking a poem, a really good poem, and making it convoluted with music kind of made it messy. And taking the lyrics of a great song and stripping out the music and just calling it a poem was a little shallow. And so I saw the two as being very different things. This project, though, I think has opened my mind up to the possibility that there are some really interesting things that can go on without forcing a poem to become a song in the conventional ways that we make songs, and still bringing that musical piece to it.
Yeah. I think a lot of artists try to figure out ways they can find their way in the world and be. And sometimes I just wonder what would happen if we just opened up and, you know, paid people for the work of art making and allowed them to pursue the creative corners and side paths that they wanted to do to see what happened. I don't know what that looks like, but a creative, if we could create a creative infrastructure that allowed people to build on, I think that would be very fascinating.
Well, what's interesting, Lori, is I don't know if that would cause it to flourish or if it would destroy it, you know, because I mean, how much of the great art comes out of that horrific struggle? And it's not like artists want to say, oh, please give me more pain in my life so I can make great art. But the reality is you get punched in the gut a few times and you got to create something about that. So I don't know.
Well, worth considering. Tell me about your notebooks. Then, did you have them all? Were you trying to get to them? What was that process
well,
like?
Well, I have allowed them to languish for a long time. I have let them sit, and I occasionally pick them up. And now, many, many years later, I picked them up with a different tool in mind. I've published more than, I've produced more than 40 albums, and I have my own process for that. I songwrite. I don't sit down, generally speaking, and take a poem and turn it into a song. I have done a little bit of that recently, and then with this, some new AI tools that have intrigued me that I've been experimenting with and trying to decide what do we as creative human beings do with these tools in a good way, collaborate with them in a good way, and how might that open up some of these things that have been languishing that I just haven't felt like I could turn that. I felt like turning them into a song would just ruin them. I've done that with a few, and it's worked out sometimes. But what happened in this album, I felt like brought out some new, fresh colors, some new angles that I hadn't noticed in the poems before.
Yeah. Were there things in your notebooks that you forgot that you had written and others that you remembered and said,
goodness,
oh yeah, this is a theme that I've been, working with my whole life?
Yeah. Well, these poems were not together. They were all, they were scattered across,
I think the earliest.
And now at this point, I can see a lot of connections, for me, that have to do with digging in the dirt, connecting with the earth, the stories that we have. In my work, I deal with a lot of helping people tell their stories, which you do as well. But there are people stories, but then there are these earth stories, things that we see that we connect with, whether they're seasonal rhythms, the story of what fall does to the trees and what the trees are doing and then how they come back around in spring, stories of the dirt, what the water does, what the grass does, what the rocks do, and also where they come together. When I was young, digging in the dirt quite often was also finding little artifacts, things that were some natural and some, like in one of the poems, a broken China doll's foot, and thinking about what's the story of that, shell casings, old shell casings. So who was shooting, and what were they shooting, and why is this here? You know,
And a boy in a juniper tree. So let's take a song like that. Let's take a song like Juniper and help us unpack where the poem is, where the song is, and where the AI tool is your partner in creating what we can hear on the album.
Yeah. The poems, what I decided absolutely was that I've done some adjusting of poems to make them into songs. I decided At this point, I thought, as a thought experiment, I think that's unfair to the poem. I'm going to leave the poem exactly as is. And then I'm going to, you know, the issue of dealing with AI is prompting. It's really a matter of how do I prompt? How many iterations of prompting and what sorts of things am I prompting?
Sure.
And how am I rendering that? And then what am I using in the next iteration as a prompt? Because not only can I use language as a prompt, I can use sound as a prompt. I can use the version of the song that I just made as an auditory prompt for the next iteration. And there's all these wonderful things that we can do. But, you know, as an educator, I keep telling teachers, we're all nervous about this AI thing.
Yeah.
Hey, the skill that our kids need to know is how to prompt. What is that? You know, how do I work with something, collaborate with something, and prompt in a way that brings it to where I need it? And then I see, okay, this is the point where now I take over. It's my turn to get in here.
Mm-hmm.
For me, most of these songs, most of my work in the writing had already been done. And then it was a very long series of prompting and reprompting and doing multiple iterations to get style, tone, vocal quality. I mean, another kind of cool thing about this is every songwriter wants to have his or her stuff covered by somebody else. It's kind of cool to hear somebody else doing your song. Well, in these, I'm not singing in any of these.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like listening to someone else who said, hey, I like this, and they've decided to cover it, you know.
What do you learn from that? So that's part of the AI tool, is the vocalization of the songs?
It is.
Yeah. So who's singing?
I guess AI is.
Okay.
You know.
And then you're hearing it back, and then that's like somebody reflecting it to you, not.
Right, yeah. And it's like collaborating. You know, I have collaborated with other human beings plenty. Mm-hmm. But I've also collaborated with a lot of things. I was thinking about this. I used to, both in poetry and in song, collaborate with random words pulled out of books or with random bits of language found here or there, and then bouncing off of that and saying, now what does that draw out of me at this point? I drive a lot for my work. I was driving with one of my colleagues, and you know those rumble strips that are on the side of the road?
Mm-hmm.
I happened to have a guitar tuner with me. I pulled over. I frightened her a little bit. I pulled over so that we were on the rumble strip and I could see what note I was hitting.
Mm.
And then we talked about what note might I hit? How fast would I have to go to hit an F sharp? So, I mean, there's mm-hmm. all these wonderful things, and I've always loved musicians and sound engineers that find sound and then bring it into something to create a song, or at least art noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you hear, it's like when you write a play and then somebody reads it for the first time, you can hear all the things you did wrong, right?
Yeah, right.
Or you can hear the things that land exactly like you wanted them to land.
Or they land nothing like you wanted them to land, but they do something surprising and different that you really absolutely love.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, this project has opened those poems up that were important to me, but it's opened them up in a new way. And not only the collaboration with AI, but having these 14 together in this collection.
Yeah. I love the idea of not making the poem turn itself into a song, but letting the poem be the poem, which makes it sound different than if you had done the opposite.
Right. There are so many conventions in songwriting. And, you know, they say repeat and vary. You know, people like to hear what is familiar, and then they like to be surprised a little bit with something that breaks out of that.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, I suppose some of that is here, but in a much larger way, it's opening up. And I think maybe to listen to this, you'll hear some things that are familiar. I've chosen Americana roots. I absolutely love folk. I love old country. Mm-hmm. I love bluegrass. I love Appalachia kinds of mountain music and stuff like that. and that seemed appropriate for the content of these poems. And so you'll hear some things that are familiar there, but then especially the language doesn't do what you would expect it to do as a song. There's not a chorus. There's not a set of verses necessarily. Yeah. There's certainly not a lot of rhyme. And so you've got to listen to it a little differently.
Yeah, which makes it feel like it is from a different tradition.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting. And then I love this as you play with what does AI as a collaborator. You also have these songs, these poems that are deeply, as you mentioned, integrated into the earth and the soil and other people, including this quiet place with strangers where you talk about this deeply human practice that comes from the Quakers of human engagement. Tell me a little bit about that, because here it is, as you're engaging with AI, we're also talking about what it means to be a human being.
Right. It's a beautiful practice that I've been fortunate enough to do, to lead, to facilitate for probably been 17 years now. As a smaller piece of my work, I facilitate some retreats. But this Clearness Committee, which does go back to an ancient Quaker practice of coming together in a circle, having a person who is the focus person and a committee that is not there to say, okay, here's what you need to do. Here's our advice for you. Here's what we've rationally thought about all that you're trying to struggle with. You're trying to figure out whether you're going to take this new job or whether you're going to do this or what that. And here's what we've decided. What they do instead is they ask open, honest questions. They ask things that help a person listen more deeply to themselves, sometimes in ways that they would not have listened to had someone not asked that question. You know, we get into these little circular patterns of thinking, especially when we're struggling with a decision, where I keep going over the same things. Oh, I can't do it because of that, and I can't do this because of that, and I'm just stuck. Having trustworthy or, in this poem, strangers who have agreed to be trustworthy in a particular way, I don't even know them, having them offer questions that help me think more deeply into it is an amazing practice. And the stranger part, you know, when I go to my spouse or my parents or my kids, somebody who knows me really well, and I say, I'm struggling with this thing, well, there's a good chance that they are kind of a big part of that, that they've already got a big stake in it. It's hard for them to be super objective in asking questions. They want to just tell me, "Oh, Dad, you should do this," or, "Honey, you need to take this approach." Well, strangers who have agreed to operate in this way can be amazingly helpful. We call them to a higher purpose than just tossing out some advice or problem solving for somebody or fixing somebody's problem. We call them to hold us, to listen deeply, and then to offer questions that might be helpful.
There's also something brand new in here, in that it doesn't come from your notebooks, and that is the poem, I Can't Sleep. Tell me about that one, please.
You know, it is exactly what it says. I could not sleep, and these days we're living in, there's just a lot of angst. We've got violence and wars happening. We've got elections. We've got all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that there are things, and we haven't sorted all of this out yet, but there are things that need to be buried. They need to be put in the grave. But the interesting piece of that is that's the same process as planting. You know, when I decide this thing, it's got to be dead and put in the ground. What's going to grow out of that, you know? And it kind of grapples with that connection. Can we bury hate? And what's going to grow if we bury hate? You know, if you bury an apple seed, you get an apple tree. But I think it's something else. If I actually can bury hate, you know, it might bear some fruit that's not hateful at all. It might bear some fruit of love and compassion.
Yeah. What does it decompose into?
Yeah. That decomposition process.
Black Hills singer-songwriter Scott Simpson, the new album, Where the Growth Begins, dropped today. Find it online at scottsimpsonmusic.com. There's more in the moment after the break. We'll head there with more music from Scott Simpson. You're on listener-supported SDPB.
We are gloves opening the garden gate. We are hands within these gloves, finishing the work of this day. Rest with me, rest with me. And all that grows in soil will be remade. Hands and gloves are digging lovely graves. Digging lovely graves. Digging lovely graves. Sleep and grow in love and shade. Me as I bury hate, bury hate. No more hate.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The founder behind the Wetechable restaurant in Sioux Falls is now a first-time author. Like his restaurant, Lawrence West's First We Harvest, Then We Cook children's book embodies the rich heritage of Lakota food. West will serve complimentary fry bread fingers and wojapi and be available for book signings on Saturday, October 26th at the Downtown Library in Sioux Falls. Ahead of the event, he stopped by the SDPB Kirby Family Studios to invite you into the pages of First We Harvest, Then We Cook.
The journey to becoming an author is hazy, very hazy. But so in 2015, I got a job as a restaurant manager, and I kind of like immersed myself in it and kind of fell in love with the restaurant industry. But obviously with the lack of representation out there for our dialect of food, just being the over, you know, go-getter that I am, it drove me to, you know, start a food truck. So I opened the food truck and things kind of progressed from there to other restaurants and more food trucks. And
so what did you love about the industry? Like, what was lighting you up about being in the industry and just being around people doing that work?
Exactly that, the people, yeah. The conversation, you know, the education aspect of it. And it's like, if you see someone on the street and you might be afraid to approach them, or that, you know, you might think they're, you know, dangerous or standoffish or, you know, whatever insecurities that you have, but over a plate of food, those insecurities don't exist because you don't have time to be worrying about, you know, ill intention or whatever. You're just enjoying great food. And you get to learn so much because it makes people open up. It helps them relax. And honestly, it's the food aspect. I mean, the conversation aspect that the food brings.
Yeah. Everybody comes to the table.
Yeah.
At some point.
Everyone. And it doesn't matter, you know.
Like, I could say, did you grow up writing? But did you grow up eating? And we all say yes.
Yes.
We all grew up eating. And you grew up in the kitchen sometimes, too. Tell me a little bit about that. How'd you learn about food?
So my, like, growing up, like, it's just in the Native American tradition to, like, potluck, you know? Like, that's how we did it. And being younger and growing up in South Dakota, that culture was a lot more prevalent back in the day. For the family gathering, you know, we used to do it in parks. We used to do it in your front yard. You know, it just used to be a lot more family. And with family comes food tradition, you know, your recipes, you're taught this by your aunt or showed that by your grandma or, you know, inspired by your mom or, you know, just different recipes. And
all right. So you decide at some point that you want to put some of what you know into this rather beautiful little book.
Thank you.
First We Harvest, Then We Cook. The harvest is really important. Going back to the source of the food, where does our food come from? It's not first we shop or let's go take a trip to the grocery store. It's first we harvest and then we cook. Where did you begin with writing this and thinking about the journey that you wanted to take readers on?
So obviously, like, The main thing that I search for or that I go after is obviously spreading the word of my people in particular. You know, like a lot of America, like blandly washes Native American into an individual singular culture. And it's not that at all, you know? So yes, there's books out there and there's things that talk about, you know, the three sisters and the, you know, the other things that are supposed to be the Native American food supply chain. But it's so vast. The only reason that those things are still talked about is because that's what people can still grow today. But the things that we're introducing are things that are natural, things that you can't grow. I can't grow them. They don't do well in captive areas. You know, they're grown on the prairie. They're natural. You can only get them from the prairie.
Yeah. So tell people what some of these things are.
The things that I chose to highlight obviously are a couple of things that I enjoy cooking with, but I also, these are like my favorite flavors, like Timsila, the prairie turnip, like from the very moment that you take it from its dry state and you put it into warm water, the oils just start like seeping into the water and it lets off like this really lavender, like just like wildflower, and it like takes up the whole room from just like one little inch and a half pod, you know? Yeah. And the texture, like when you bite into it, it's just like so silky, and it's like, and honestly, it's like you're eating, like the texture of it is like wood, you know? Like if you remember as like a kid, if you were like chewing on a stick, but it's like really, really, really soft. I mean, the texture of it is like a solid, you know, but like the flavor and the meltiness of it is something that like you just have to taste.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time where you made the connection between that taste and what it was? Like, did someone teach you how to harvest it? Did you find it somewhere in the wild?
So I first had it like in a soup at a wake when I was younger, because Taniga is the traditional soup that generally Timsila is used in. Some people call the soup Timsila, but it's not. It's called Taniga.
Okay.
And it's made with Timsila and white hominy, bison stomach, and then just like sage and other natural like flavors and stuff. But so I probably learned what it was that I was eating when I was maybe like 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go and self-educate at the time. But I just learned from my grandmother. My grandma, Mert Howard, taught me like a ton of stuff about like the old ways of the people, you know?
Yeah. So. And is this, the book is dedicated to Joyce and Mert. Who's Joyce?
Joyce is my other grandma. So Joyce, well, they're... Our last name is Bowker, but Joyce Pease is her married name, and Mert Howard are sisters, and they're my grandmothers.
Yeah, so dedicated to the grandmas.
Yes.
I love that. All right, so Timsila, what, and choke cherries.
Choke cherries, oh my God.
Tell me about choke cherries. Yeah.
So out of choke cherries, and it mentions in there wild plums, but essentially they're harvested the same exact way. I favor wild plums over choke cherries because choke cherries have like, they're like a bitter cherry taste. And I mean, they taste like, I eat it and I enjoy it. But if we're talking about like going out and harvesting, I'm going to harvest a wild plum over the choke cherry every time, just because it's got like that sweeter snap, and it and you can taste like there's no citric acid, like it's not like a processed food, you know. So choke cherries and wild plums essentially grow on bushes and short bushes and short trees, but they ripen late July, early August, and they're harvested the same way. You just go out and you shake your bush and your berries fall down, and they're used for anything. Like back in the day, choke cherries were used to like dye quills or like paint or dye horsehair for headdresses and different things. But also mostly, like, when you get the choke cherries, you have to process them instantly because they don't hold because they're such a small berry.
Okay.
There's nothing to decompose. So you harvest the berries, you grind them instantly, and you separate the seeds, and then you make the 3-inch pucks, and you freeze them. And then when you want choke cherries, and this is how they were made back in the day, but they weren't frozen back in the day. They would sun dry them, and then they would keep them in that state until they were ready to cook them and preserve, or, you know.
Yeah.
But we make them and keep them in the freezer.
And sage.
Sage. Absolutely. Mm. Sage. Mm. So sage has got to be one of my favorite things. And obviously I wanted to put that in the first book because that's pertinent to the people, you know, like sage is probably one of the most prominent things. And that holds true, you know, in the teachings and the tellings and stuff for what we use it for. And I mean, it's used for one number of things, any number of things from ceremony to cooking to just having, you know. Like, it's sort of like a security blanket, like a protection thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. And harvesting it, not to the base.
Yeah, not to the
base. This idea of harvesting responsibly, yeah?
Yeah, so like the Timsila, you want to dig underground and you want to get the bulb because that's exactly what the Timsila is the bulb that produces the plant. But say, like, when you're harvesting sage, if you touch the roots, it's dead. It's just not going to grow back. And it's kind of like, I wouldn't say it's extinct, but it's getting there, you know? And a lot of people, and this is the thing, and this is probably the most important message and the reason why I started writing first we harvest and then we cook books is because people misconstrue conventional farming with the Native American food supply chain. Fresh food and Native American food supply chain are two totally different things, okay? So the construct of colonialism was to destroy the Native American food supply chain, okay? So conventional farming was invented by a specific group of people, right? And those specific group of people's intentions were to destroy or to decimate or to, you know, to wipe out the Native American food supply chain. So the things that are in the pesticides and things that they say are treating the land, the things that they're treating or killing is the Native American food supply chain. The things that modern farming constitute as weeds, we ate that traditionally. Like 9 out of 10 of the plants. Hmm. So, and that's the thing is like people say farm fresh or farmer's market. And yes, I love it. I buy all of my food in my restaurant from local farmers. I go and source it from them. But local farming, modern farming, farming in its entire construct was designed and created to destroy the Native American food supply chain. Because the people that invented farming didn't see our food as food. They didn't eat it. It wasn't food to them. They wanted to get that out of the way so they can till the land, plant their corn, plant their beans, plant their squash, whatever it is that they wanted to plant there, you know, their cucumbers, cherries, tomatoes, whatever, you know.
What can be reclaimed through education and through practice of cooking? Yeah.
That's a good question. Honestly, the education factor of it and my position of it is to educate my people, you know, because it's like a lot of people are like, oh, as Native Americans, we need to educate other people. Other people need to be, you know this information. In all actuality, it's like, yeah, other people should know this information, but after years of assimilation and meth abuse and reservation and you know, drug use, you know, the children that are should know this information nowadays don't have this information either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like one group or one type of people. We hope to restore this knowledge into the hands of the intended people that it's for so that they can continue to harvest in this way, because these things are all over on the prairie down there, you know, and but you don't identify them. You know, people will walk over them to go smoke weed by the lake or, you know, go, you know, and it's like, stop and look at them, you know, dig them up. And like off topic, like at my house, I make a blend of oil when I cook my fry bread, and it's 0% trans fat, like the whole nine yards, right? But at my home, I have cups of like all of the things that are processed down to make my oils, and I, you know, I touch them and I smell them and I taste them, and and without using your five senses and going out and self-educating and immersing in this knowledge that's being passed down, like, it's just gonna die, it's gonna go away, and I don't want that to happen.
Yeah, tell me about the illustrator of the book.
Oh my God,
Ella Ratliff.
I really honestly just want you to reach out to her, and and because we didn't get to work together per se. Like, she created Chepa, the logo. I reached out to her when I was changing from the food truck to a restaurant, and I said, hey, I need something to represent my change. I was like, but also at the end of the day, I was like, Wantechable is not dying. I was like, in 20 years, I'll have 2,000 restaurants all over the country. I was like, so why not just get in the game now? And I was like, this is what I want. And she sent Chepa back, and I was like, dope, awesome. Yes, absolutely, you know. And then when I was writing the book, I had just kind of mentioned it to her, and I said, hey, would you be interested in helping me with this children's book? I was like, it's something that I've wanted to do. I was like, I'm not an author. I was like, I'm not an educator. I was like, I just have this knowledge. And instead of, you know, telling each individual person, I just want to put it out there so that people can come and go from it. I was like, but I want it to be more than just a bland book, you know, like, and after I seen the illustrations, I was like, my words don't matter. Like, I literally can take my words out and just give you this book. And it's like,
it's beautiful.
Yeah. You would still kind of understand, you know, from the pictures, what's going on in there. And I don't know where her headspace was at, but she did her thing on them illustrations. I don't know. And we've never actually spoke about it.
Yeah.
I'm just grateful that I was able to partner with her on this. And I mean, I would honestly love to know her thoughts.
Yeah. We will reach out to Ella and invite her on the show. Lawrence West, thank you so much for talking to us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
First-time author and restaurateur Lawrence West will hold a book signing at the Downtown Library in Sioux Falls on October 26th. Learn more at siouxlandlibraries.org. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is also a podcast. If you missed your favorite episode, you can find it on podcast streaming platforms. Scroll through, find your favorite show, and take a listen. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.